In a letter to the Washington City paper, Thomas Sweat wrote, "I sat there a long time trying to get my nerves together because this was a huge house and wasn't quite sure it was going to burn. Just like this house, none of the fires were easy." For 25 years, the serial arsonist Thomas Sweat terrorized neighborhoods throughout the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. When at least he was arrested in 2005, he confessed over 350 arson set fires that claimed the lives of four people. This is his unbelievable story.
Recorded in Rocket City, USA. No bullshit. Just real talk. And now Deuce Conrad.
If you were an arson investigator in Washington, D.C. during the time, you would be shocked not only by the crime, but the criminal profile of the arsonist himself. Why, you ask? Well, quite simply, he didn't match the profile of most serial arsonists. You see, behind the mask of this crazy, perverted, demented killer serial arsonist is none other than Thomas Sweat. Sweat is an African-American homosexual loner who at the time was in his late 50s and had worked for various fast food joints throughout his lifetime, and he had turned Washington, D.C. upside down and into a living hell. You see, 82% of serial arsonists are white males, and most have multiple prior felony arrests. Thomas Sweat was not only way off the radar, he was nowhere on it. Sweat had managed to stay under the radar for so many years because he didn't fit that accepted profile of a serial arsonist, which was a white male, older, and feeling wronged by society. Now, as we mentioned, Thomas Sweat was a homosexual loner who had been a fry cook at a Roy Rogers and other fast food chains, as well as a manager of a KFC Pizza Hut store. That is going to play a role later on in this story. But you also need to understand that Thomas Sweat was also obsessed with the United States Marine Corps. Now, that was both as self-identification and as part of a sexual fascination with men in uniform, even though Sweat had never been a Marine. And in fact, he had been rejected by the United States Navy in the 1970s. John C. Shamble, a federal public defender who represented Mr. Sweat, said that his client had suffered a mental illness that resulted in radical and uncontrollable shifts in behavior. Mr. Shamble said that he did not have a choice. Or did he? Could it just be that Thomas Sweat was pure evil? Well, you make that decision for yourself. Let's go back to the early morning hours of January the 11th, 1985. Thomas, at the time, was 30 years old and working as a fry cook, and he had just finished his late shift at the Roy Rogers. It was there that he stepped out onto Florida Avenue Northeast. That particular day, a light snow had dusted the streets. Sweat, a bachelor, started his regular walk home alone in the cold after the restaurant had closed. It was one of those moments that reminded Sweat how oppressive wintertime in the city could be. On the sidewalk, he spotted a stranger walking in the opposite direction. The man spoke as he passed, and Sweat had nodded hello back to him. The man appeared to be in his 30s, and he was attractive. Thomas Sweat liked him immediately. And as the man continued to walk northwest on the thoroughfare, Sweat turned and followed him. Sweat wanted to meet him. He wanted to meet him so bad that he tailed the stranger beneath the train overpass, over New York Avenue and North Capitol Street, and up to a brick row house on Quincy Place Northwest, where it abuts Florida Avenue. There, Thomas watched the man walk inside the house, presumably to his family. Again, Thomas Sweat was alone on the street. Sweat turned to renew his walk home, and which was going to be even longer now. But still, he wanted to meet this stranger, this man. And he found himself walking faster and faster towards home, excited, telling himself he'd see the man at least one more time. But the only way would be through Fryer, Sweat would later write. At home, Thomas Sweat stripped off his Roy Rogers uniform. There he threw on some casual clothes. He borrowed his sister's car and he headed back towards the house at Florida and Quincy. But this time there was just one stop to make, and that was at a local gas station, where he topped off an empty 2-liter soda bottle with gasoline, then threw it into his bag along with a towel. He parked near Quincy Place and got out of the car with his bag. On the front porch, he poured the gasoline beneath the front door, and he held it there with a towel, and he struck a match. The vapors ignited in the front hallway. The smoke started pouring out beneath the door. Sweat hopped back into his sister's car as terror began to fold inside. On the second floor of the house, a man woke to find his bedroom in flames. On the same floor where his wife, his daughter, and his stepdaughter, and in the basement where his son and stepson were. Thomas Sweat circled the block in his car and he came back to the house. And on the front porch, the man stood in nothing but his underwear. Thomas said, "I was glad to see him again and I wanted to help, but the fire trucks were coming." The man had escaped through a window, but not before suffering asphyxia from the smoke, as well as first, second, and third degree burns over 60% of his body. He must have been too panicked to register his injuries. He was screaming that his wife was still inside. From the street, Sweat could hear one of the boys hollering for help at a basement window. He even briefly considered getting out of his car to save the boy, but the fire engine was already barreling down towards the blaze, and so he decided to flee the scene. It took 85 firefighters more than 45 minutes to get the fire under control, and according to an article in the Washington Post, the boys escaped unharmed. The two girls emerged from the back of the house, each badly burned. The mother was nowhere to be found. Neighbors gathered in front of the house as officials sorted the wreckage, and they broke into sobs when the body was found inside the house around dawn. The medical examiner on scene determined she had died of burns and asphyxia. In the official fire report, an investigator assigned a cause. The fire started as a result of a carelessly dropped cigarette in the bedding a second floor bedroom. It appeared to be just another sad, needless fire in a city that was accustomed to seeing thousands each year. Now, when he saw the fire in the news, Sweat learned the name of the man he had just made a widower, Roy Picott. He had also learned the name of the deceased, Bessie Mae Duncan. This would be the first of 353 fires and the first of four people who would lose their lives at the hand of Thomas Sweat. At Robin Hood, we think investing is better with friends. So for everyone you invite to join, you'll both earn a reward of stock. As soon as your friend signs up and links their bank account, we'll credit each of your accounts with a reward stock. Now keep in mind, you can receive up to $500 in reward stocks each calendar year. So feel free to spread the word. Go to www.deuceconradshow.com and select the promotions link, and from there you can sign up directly with Robinhood today. When Thomas Sweat saw an attractive man, he would follow him home. But instead of talking to the object of his affection, Sweat would set fire to the man's house or car. For more than 30 years, Sweat set hundreds of fires in the metro Washington, D.C. area. Sweat often tossed incendiary devices into police cars and then watched them burn. And, you know, each time he set a fire, he would use a similar gadget. He would fill up a milk jug with gasoline and plug the opening with a piece of clothing that had served as a wick. The wick burned plastic for more than 20 minutes, and then after the fire consumed the container, gas fumes escaped and caught fire. In two different fires, elderly women were unable to escape and later died. In 2005, Thomas A. Sweat admitted in court to setting 45 fires across the Washington region, claiming two lives. But even then, he had only just begun to confess to his crimes. You see, on a car tour, in 2 days of interviews with investigators, the then 50-year-old fast food manager directed agents to 309 additional fires, which he said that he had started going back 20 years, including one on Quincy Place in Northwest Washington in 1985 that killed a couple and had initially been ruled an accident. Wow. You know, Sweat's agreement with prosecutors barred them from using those talks to charge him with more crimes, according to a federal law enforcement agent and a man whose father died in a blaze and was briefed by police. So, in exchange for his full accounting, Sweat agreed to be in prison for life plus 136 years on a selected number of offenses he admitted to in court. "We felt an obligation to the victim," said Scott Fulkerson, who, with his partner, led the arson investigation for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. And he was explaining why it was important to get closure even when it meant foregoing additional charges. Fulkerson, who is now in charge of the ATF office in Richmond, said his most difficult task was telling the four siblings who had escaped the blaze at Quincy Place that the flames that killed their parents, Bessie Mae Duncan and Roy Picott, were apparently started by Sweat and not by a discarded cigarette, as the D.C. Fire Department had initially determined. "It wasn't an easy day for us," Fulkerson said. "It was more difficult. It was a more difficult day for the family." But how did authorities get it wrong for so many years? How did they miss Sweat as a suspect? And more importantly, how did he get caught? Now, like the 2002 Washington area sniper attacks, you know, the jarring unpredictability of the fires filled residents with fear and frustrated investigators who initially didn't link the blazes. Now, that being said, the fires were set in almost identical ways, with homemade bombs of plastic 1 gallon jugs filled with gasoline, topped with that piece of cloth, as we talked about, being used as a wick and wrapped in a plastic bag for easy transport. You know, investigators described the arsons as diabolical, saying the incendiary devices were often left outside exits to the home. And in fact, a law enforcement task force secretly labored for years from a warren of empty laboratories at the Beltsville Agricultural Research Center. And it was there that they chased more than 1,000 dead-end leads trying to catch a serial arsonist before he killed again. But just as with the DC sniper, they had been looking for the wrong person. You know, we've all seen criminal profiling on hit TV shows and films like Criminal Minds, The Silence of the Lambs, Cracker, and Mindhunter. And we've heard the legendary tales of profilers catching elusive serial killers and other horrific offenders. And it seems like in each case, profilers are depicted as having psychic-like talents used to predict features of an unknown suspect based upon behaviors at the crime scene alone. But how accurate is this portrayal? Well, contrary to popular belief, most of the work on criminal profiling is not conducted by members of the famed FBI Behavioral Science Unit. In fact, 7% of all profiling publications, which were authored by the FBI special agents and profilers, most profilers are actually psychologists or criminologists. And the majority of offender profiling publications came out in the last decade, between 2006 and 2016, were not authored by profilers or special agents in the FBI. Who were they authored by? Psychologists and criminologists. So when we look at how these authors developed these profiles, it is very clear that there was a huge divide. Some profilers used a scientific process involving statistical analysis of data on crimes and the responsible offenders. Others used a more clinical process where profilers were developed using the FBI profilers described as experience, intuition, and educated guesswork. But in fact, the study found that over half of the profiling publications used no statistical analysis, while just over a quarter used advanced statistics and data to develop their offender profiles. What that means is that even profiles have a margin of error, and so it was very easy for Thomas Swett to fall through the cracks. And despite a nationwide manhunt, it would be a chance encounter that finally snagged the DC snipers. You know, John Muhammad and his baby-faced accomplice, Lee Malvo, confounded the cultural trope of the white male serial killer. But Thomas Swett was no different. In the end, it was a combination of sheer doggedness, serendipitous meeting with military officials about DNA evidence from a pair of Marine dress blues left behind at a fire scene, and an unusually cooperative suspect that would crack the case, not criminal profiling.
Do you have a beard? It's a legitimate question. You know, a beard says a lot about a man. A beard can define a man just by looking at him. Screw what they say. You can judge a book by its cover, and a beard is one hell of a cover. But let me ask you this. How do you take care of your beard? Are you putting chemicals into your face that will basically eat the hide off of a zombie? Stop that shit. Be a badass and start using badass beard care. Look, it's all natural. It's made by badass vets. And it will make your beard so incredibly soft, so incredibly manly. And you can get a free trial set today by going to deuceconrad.com and selecting On Promotions.
A sloppy Thomas Swett and advanced technology would lead to his arrest. Starting in 2003, Washington, D.C. and Prince George's County, Maryland became infested with a rash of arson fires. Thomas Swett was at the height of his longtime elusiveness from capture. You know, maybe he became complacent. Or it could be that he was just ignorant of advanced investigative techniques. Nonetheless, police were narrowing in on Swett as he was linked to the fires through DNA evidence found at two scenes where a fingerprint, some skin cells on a wick, and a single hair all matched his genetic profile. And for Swett, different fires grew out of different feelings. Many out of a sense of powerlessness, others out of spite, and some even out of love. But more than anything else, his decades-long rampage was about a sexual fantasy. Why did I set the fires when I set them? That's an all too familiar question that cannot be understood if you don't know the story. There were different reasons, he wrote, for most of the fires. It could be because of one feeling the need to have power about something or someone. I don't want you driving that car so the fire becomes a weapon to destroy it. Or in a case of some house fires, I might like a particular style of a house and wish one day to own it, but it's only a dream. Fire is a tool to destroy, and some house fires also become my fantasy of people scrambling to exit windows and sort of feel like they need my help, so I stay and watch. Then I'd masturbate over the fire while driving away from the scene. Sweated, boarded in cheap rooms all over town before he settled in Southeast in 1992. And for a few $100 a month, he rented an apartment in a two-story brick house on La Balm Street, Southeast. Now, it was a relatively poor neighborhood close to the gritty strip of liquor stores and check-cashing operations along Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue. But even though he was civic-minded, he was hardly sociable. He wasn't the type to knock on a neighbor's door or start up a sidewalk conversation. Instead, he enjoyed tending to his building's property, mowing the front lawn and clearing trash from the alley and sidewalk. When local drunks or homeless offered to pitch in, Sweat would gladly accept the offer and reward them with a drink or a cigarette. He was also proud of his flair for interior design. People would visit and say, "Wow, this is a huge apartment and nicely decorated." Sweat said, "I like that." But no matter what good, nice things people said, I never felt better. And that depressed feeling wouldn't go away. Instead, it'd make me want to go out and do evil stuff like setting something afire. On days off from work, he would read do-it-yourself books he and his sister actually sidelined in home renovation. Then we both became masters of the trade and renovated apartments as well as houses, he said. On my days off, I would work at the apartments. I did kitchens completely, including floors, walls, cabinets, and molding. And we saved a lot of money, too. And at the same time, my thoughts would wonder a lot about the tenants. Only knew that I was the person responsible for many fires and that it was easy for them to have become a victim. I felt like that was my world, he wrote of La Balm Street. The people were friendly, not a lot of money in the neighborhood, but everybody was happy-go-lucky, if you know what I mean. But that was also part of the good, that was the good part of Tom, that people saw and only knew. Then when darkness fell, it was the other person living inside of me. Once Sweat moved to La Balm Street, the neighborhood started burning. Vacant building fires, home fires, store fires. Hell, he even burned the garage that stood behind his apartment. He burned the neighborhood carryout and the neighborhood laundromat. When he was on the receiving end of a bad haircut at Kenny and Paul's barbershop, yeah, he came back and he torched the place. The barbershop rebounded. But when Sweat tired of the addicts who took to hanging on the block, he torched it again. You see, there are lots of barbershops and carryouts as well as gas stations. I like barbershops because they were always attractive men there. Crazy as it may sound, I had a fascination for barbers. Throughout the 80s and 90s, Sweat lit scores of fires throughout the eastern side of the city. And oddly enough, he never heard a knock on his door from a detective. Probably because he rarely strayed from the city's poor corners. And though his unchecked terror doesn't speak well for D.C.'s arson investigators, they had their hands full. Because the city was classifying more than 200 fires per year as acts of arson as back as early as the early 90s. That's compared to about a third of that number today.
Since 1999, Rakuten has paid its members over $2 billion in cash back. Formerly known as Ebates, Rakuten is an affiliate reseller of over 2,500 online retailers. Rakuten passes part of their commission on their sales back to you in the form of a cash back payment. You see, you earn cash back by using the Rakuten online shopping portal. And using Rakuten is very simple and easy. There are no fees or forms you need to fill out to get your money. But to get the cash back, all you have to do is start any online shopping you do at the Rakuten website. You'll click through their site to your preferred online store, such as Target, Walmart, Sephora, Macy's, Nike, and many more. And then simply make your purchase as usual. Easy, right? Well, I'm going to make it even better for you being a listener of the Deuce Conrad Show. As a first-time shopper, you will get up to $30 to use on your first purchase. Of course, certain terms and conditions apply. Visit www.deuceconradshow.com and select promotions to get started today.
After doing it, so long, it just became easier and easier. But the fear of getting caught was always there. Each fire was like doing the first time, and I'd always take deep breaths and ask the Lord to forgive me for what I'm about to do. Thomas went on to say that each one was special in its own way. In the spring of 2003, Sweat paid a price for his jurisdiction hopping. You see, a couple of fire officials from D.C. and Prince George's County were swapping notes at a promotional exam when they realized that a rash of suspicious fires had been set along their shared border. The fires had a number of features in common. The homes were mostly detached and single-family. The fires were set on porches or near doorways, and they were always set in the early morning hours. Forensic tests at an ATF lab determined that each fire was set with the same kind of device, some sort of plastic jug, perhaps a milk or juice container, that had been filled with gasoline and carried to the scene inside of a plastic bag. The lab work linked 4 of the fires for certain, and another 15 recent fires were deemed similar looking. Now, even with all that commonality, victims appeared to have nothing to do with each other. In fact, investigators created a floor-to-ceiling map showing the locations of all the arsonist fires. This is a process known as geographic profiling, and they hoped to configure something that might suggest something about the arsonist's daily life. It's a linear pattern, for instance, that would tell you to look into a local delivery man with a criminal past, for example. But the D.C. arsonist fires were scattered. Their location suggested that the fire setter lacked greenery near the homes that he burned, and that he preferred low-income and working-class neighborhoods. Most of the fires had been set near exits. So the arsonist appeared, or apparently had hoped, to kill or at least terrify the people inside. By mid-July 2003, investigators were looking at about 24 recent fires, including one that killed an 86-year-old Washington woman. The ATF and local law enforcement launched what would become an exhausting, nearly 2-year manhunt for the arsonist. Now, in order for them to learn more about how these fires unfolded, agents created models of the arsonist device with plastic jugs and cloth wicks. They performed stage burns at the lab and out in the field on a home slated for demolition. And so they were surprised by what they found. When the wick was lit, a gallon jug filled with gasoline didn't ignite as one might suspect. You see, gasoline itself doesn't burn. Only its vapors. So the narrow opening at the top of the jug allowed only so many vapors to escape at a time. The gasoline itself acted as a coolant, letting the device burn as slow and steady as a kerosene lamp. So it could be really 20 minutes or so before the jug's plastic melted, allowing the gasoline and its accompanying vapors to spread across the porch. Now, it was at that point that the fire would reach the wood or aluminum siding. What did Thomas Sweat have to say about this? He said, "I get aroused just the thought of big shoes. Big patterned leather boots. From childhood all the way up to even now, I always wondered why I liked to masturbate over my uncle's shoes. Sleep with them in his bed when he's away. My father's shoes too. I always was glad to see darkness fall so I could sneak outside and go behind the house where my father's bedroom was and peep through the window, only to see him lying on the bed reading the paper. I would masturbate over his big, black, shiny shoes. Crazy stuff, right? But no one never found out these obsessions that I have. I kept them hid, as you stated in your letter. When we had church meeting at our home, I can still picture this one member standing outside in the backyard congregating with others. I could see him through a bathroom window and have fantasies of him ejecting off. His shoes were an orange, brown colors, but military style. You know, I wonder if he still has those. It really goes all the way back to childhood. Never felt loved by family, and even now I say I love them. But it's really very hard to feel it in my heart. Even during visits, they pretend. Also, I know because it's all the expression on their face that tells me so. And even on the phone, I never probably will learn the reason why. I trusted others' judgments and decisions over mine, or should I say just easy to be persuaded. I have trouble explaining why I do certain things. I look for answers to many questions, but only left with more question marks. Why? Even here on my record, it states personality disorder. You know, I'll be your friend, yet turn around and don't want anything else to do with you. Crazy. You see, when Thomas saw companionship, he cruised the city's gay underbelly near the Navy Yard clubs or along Georgia Avenue Northwest Corridor. He loved men with athletic builds, though sometimes he would find himself attracted to someone for an inexplicable reason, like the size of his feet. 11 and 12s were his favorite. Or it could be his unusual gait. Pigeon toes just made him swoon. Thomas said, "I was working at Holly's Farms, a restaurant off of Georgia Avenue in Decatur. And I could work, I could walk home from work if necessary. And I had a special friend. We used to go to the clubs almost every night, drinking and smoking. We had a nice time, but there was always this need to be loved by young guys on the street. I wasn't a thug, but I was attracted to street life. So after leaving the clubs and bars, he would take me home and ask if I needed the car for the next day. And of course, I'd say yes. But that same night, I went cruising up Georgia Avenue and I picked up this young guy named Tyrone. We became best friends until I became obsessed with him, which drove me to set his house afire. Actually, it was his aunt's house on Peabody and 3rd. She was slightly injured and the house was damaged, just the basement where he lived. You know, I was glad that she didn't get hurt. We Well, Tyrone was a boxer and very handsome, and he used to come over to my apartment on Wednesday night to watch Dynasty TV show together. The night before the fire, I went inside the basement of the place he lived at and took all of his clothes, his tennis shoes, some of which I bought for him. He wore size 12 shoes. That was attractive to me, and I would actually go to bed with his shoes on my pillow just so I could smell the odor. Sweat set that fire back in the early 80s when he was starting to see that he showed two faces to the world. One was that of a church-going, working man who performed random works of charity and bid good afternoon to the neighbors. The other face was that of a lonesome and violent obsessive who never shared his unspeakable urges with anyone. Trying to reconcile these two people would be the fundamental crisis of his life. You know, it's really something to think about, knowing that as a child, one grows up to be known as a serial arsonist. It's such a degrading name. And I don't like to be recognized as such. Sweat went on to say, but it is what it is, and life goes on.
Are you looking for unbiased news in a world of biased media? Look no further. 1440 provides an impartial view of what's happening in the world so our readers can form their own conclusions. 1440 scours hundreds of sources each and every day to bring you a single morning briefing thoughtfully curated by experts, straight to your email with no haggling or unnecessary spam. Get even more benefits by signing up through the Deuce Conrad Show affiliate link. Visit www.deuceconradshow.com and select promotions to sign up today.
In June of 2003, a raging two-alarm fire on Everett Street Northeast claimed the life of 86-year-old Lou Edna Jones. Investigators had hoped the blaze was accidental, but when forensic tests proved the arsonist was behind it, they found the fire deeply troubling. You see, they'd already linked another fire from the same night, set about 2.5 miles away, near RFK Stadium, just 50 minutes before the one on Everett's, which meant their arsonists had no problem lighting doubles, as they call a pair of fires set one after another. It shows that nothing is stopping him, said Fulkerson. While I was there, I took some photographs of the property and I mailed them to Sweat, asking him to tell me the story of the fire. You know, the Jones family never learned why the arsonist chose their home. But he wrote back, the pictures were so clear and bright. It must have been a beautiful day for taking them. I was not surprised to learn that Lou Edna Jones's house remained the same. Someone had been cutting the grass and weeds had grown up. The front porch is almost completely gone. I think about this house the most because it's where a death occurred. And that was not my intentions. But I knew all the fires there would be risky for human life. That fire occurred around 4:30 a.m., just as people were waking up or coming to work early morning hours, such as the delivery man for papers, Metro bus driver, which is right in the area. I sat there a long time trying to get my nerves together because this was a huge house and wasn't quite sure it would burn. Just like this house, none of the fires were easy. Like the house on Anacostia Avenue, I sat there so long that the occupants drove past and saw me sitting on their porch. That was about 30 or 40 minutes, way too long, and way too early for a fire. 11:30 p.m., what was I thinking? But Dave, it's hard to think about It's hard to think that for about 3 years or more that she's been dead. And I often pray for forgiveness and ask God to help the victim's family cope with her struggles. Yesterday, my mother came to visit me here in Terre Haute with sisters and a niece. I couldn't help but think of what it's like not to have a mother. You're exactly right about Lou Edna Jones having a lot of grandchildren, and it was her great-grandson that led me back to that house later that night, only because I didn't know him personally. But I saw him get the mail out of the mailbox on the front porch, and he was tall, and he had a masculine build, and I wanted to meet him. So I would live out my fantasy through fire, watching him jump out of the window for help and come running to me. I raced home to watch the news and was saddened about the fatality, but was fascinated by this huge fire. Wow! I will always remember this house. Edna Jones never made it out of her bedroom above the front porch. She had been asphyxiated by smoke, and her feet burned from trying to escape. You know, investigators assumed the arsonist saw his fires in the news. They assumed he followed the story of Everett Street. Then he knew that he had killed somebody, yet continued setting fires anyway. Investigators couldn't believe that Sweat had set his first fire in March 2003 and then graduated to murder in June. Now, you see, the timeline was blown wide open. We started to figure that we needed to go way back, said ATF agent Tom Daly. They visited firehouses in the arsonist's favorite neighborhoods and pored over old run books. They dissected logs that included a handwritten entry for every fire a truck had been called to. They looked for any suspicious-looking fires that were set on porches. Daly said that they pulled log books from decades ago. But even more disheartening, catching the arsonist in the act seemed nearly impossible. But one October morning in 2003, someone called 911 to report a fire on the front porch of a home on Otis Street Northeast. Investigators had been waiting for this moment. A task force agent was staked out with his radios nearby. And he actually arrived on the scene before the fire truck did. This would be just a matter of minutes after the fire had started. And investigators managed to shut down the surrounding blocks and canvass the area as the fire burned. But unfortunately, their man had already disappeared. How intoxicating that must have been for Thomas Sweat to manipulate investigators like that. Up to 55 agents were working the case at a given time. They were sent out into the streets on a needle in the haystack stakeout that lasted all night long. Eventually listening to as many as 5 different police and fire radios to cover all of the jurisdictions. Sweat found a thrill in walking among the agents who were hurting him. You know, his ego satisfied knowing that he was always a step ahead. More than once, he spotted a pair of exhausted-looking agents staked out at a 7-Eleven on Bladensburg Road Northeast. He said he walked right past their car. Investigators have confirmed assigning agents at this location. Thomas said, "I like the attention from setting fires, the blue and red lights flashing from the fire trucks and police cars, the rushing of firefighters hooking up the hoses to putting out the flames and people gathered to watch. They were an arm's length to arrest me. And I recognized them at many locations, especially the fires in Northeast and PG County." When Sweat started venturing into new neighborhoods, investigators felt like they were being toyed with. Shortly before 5 one morning in November 2003, he lit a gallon jug of gasoline on fire at a house in Alexandria. Virginia officials called in members of the arson task force who had never thought they needed to travel west of the Potomac River in the course of this investigation. When they linked this new fire, they realized their case was now blown open in space as well as in time. They had been splurging all their manpower on one side of the district and part of Prince George's County. On February 6, 2004, Sweat ventured to the Alexandria section of Fairfax County and set a fire to an apartment building. Then on Valentine's Day, he lit one of his devices on the stairwell of an apartment building on Blair Road, just over the district line in Montgomery County, where investigators had never followed him. And because the fire started between the first and second floors, it blocked residents on the upper floors from coming down the stairs. A woman and her two daughters were forced to sprint through the flames to escape. Outside, Thomas Sweat watched as an older woman hung from the upper floor window, apparently gasping for air. "I can still see her," he wrote. The Blair Road fire never fully destroyed its starting device. A shopping bag, a gallon jug, and a swatch from a pair of black socks. These items were sent to the Montgomery County Crime Lab, where a lab technician pulled off what her new colleagues at the ATF considered a feat of forensic science. Even though the cloth from the slacks had been burned and charred, the technician was able to extract a trace amount of DNA that for some reason never succumbed to the heat. That DNA from that apartment fire matched the DNA taken from the attempted fire at the boys' house on Anacostia Avenue in D.C. At the task force headquarters, there was a brief spell of euphoria. "You know, it gives you a great feeling for 24 hours, Daly says, but then the next day it's like, what's his name? And I have no idea. What they had was DNA, not a suspect. And to underscore just how far they still were from solving the case, an agent with a comic streak put a wanted poster up on the wall of the headquarters. In place of suspect's portrait was a double helix, and in place of the suspect's name was a line of genetic code. You see, without a name, they had nothing but theories. Some entertained the idea that the arsonist was affiliated with law enforcement, firefighting, or the military. And, in the strangest way, he was. Thomas Sweat said that his whole life had been a fantasy. He said that if he could have been anything other than a fry cook, he would have been a Marine. People who knew him casually would have laughed at the thought, but it actually made sense. You see, he believed in old-fashioned concepts like honor and heroism, and all his life he had felt a desperate need to belong somewhere. And he appreciated order and cleanliness. He probably would have had the tidiest locker in the barracks. Sweat once tried to enlist in the Navy in 1976 when he was 21 years old. He had passed the aptitude test, but he failed the physical. And he never forgot that rejection. At the same time, he never really accepted it. You see, Thomas Sweat thought duty and courage were beautiful things, and nothing embodied those traits so crisply as a military uniform. The sight of young black men in Marine dress blue sent Sweat into fits of lust. And this happened often. The greater D.C. area offered plenty of bases and barracks for a military fetish to visit when he needed to see the standing collar, light blue trousers, milk-white gloves, and leather shoes of a doughboy. You see, the real world may have dismissed Sweat as a soldier, but in his mind, he made himself one. I bet you have been to Walmart at some time in your life and probably shopped there. I bet you even probably get groceries there from time to time. Did you know that Walmart has grocery pickup? And in fact, I can save you $15 on your first order of $50 or more. For more information, go to www.deuceconradshow.com and select promotions. There will be a link there where you can sign up as a new customer. And again, you'll save $15 on that first order of $50 or more. In his time off from KFC, he would drive out of the city to military recruiter stations. He would get there before the officers and watch them as they went into work. Sometimes he would film them from his car and later masturbate to the videos. If they left any military-issued cars unlocked in the lot, he'd come back at night and collect whatever pieces of regalia they had left behind until he had assembled a complete uniform. Then he would order the matching leather shoes to go with it. At home, he dressed like a Marine and putter around the apartment, playing the role for no audience but himself. And he never wore the uniform outside. He did set fire to recruiter stations as far away as Richmond. His fantasies encompassed all kinds of civil servants who wore uniforms. Police officers, firefighters, even bus drivers. He reported false fires on his block just to bring the engines out. He sometimes lingered at the scenes of the fires he'd set himself, capturing footage with his camera. He had become addicted to his homemade pornography. Sweat felt deeply conflicted over cops. Now, he was physically attracted to them, but he resented their authority. And that feeling may have stemmed from the minor brushes he had had with them in the past. And in 1984, he was arrested for stealing some $2,500 in jewelry out of the home of a man he had picked up at a party, according to court records. Now, he did agree to complete a court-ordered diversion program, and the government dropped his case. Or maybe he just never forgot the D.C. officers that mocked his soft voice when he took their orders at KFC. Whatever it was that he loved and despised in cops, he saw it in their squad cars. They were physical objects themselves, and they had a way of stirring his feelings, sometimes more than people. The sight of a cruiser would make him feel powerless and slighted, and so he would torch them around town. Thomas said, "I burned police cruisers parked at the station and some that were at their residence. To me, they seemed to have power because of their badge and gun, and I felt powerful through fire when they lost their vehicles. Some of the burned cars would remain at the spot for many days, and I'd drive back at night just to stare and smell the smoke." One of the stations was on Pennsylvania Avenue and Minnesota Avenue Southeast, and one of the police residences was on Wheeler Road at Mississippi Avenue Southeast. Some people use guns, knives, etc. as weapons. I use fire as a source of weapon. Not afraid of fire at all, for it was my friend and I miss it. You mentioned small, safe fires. Well, that's correct about the small leading to big fires, and I just needed more satisfaction and excitement. I must have masturbated 100 times a day. That's all I wanted to do was make tapes and come home and watch them. With the exception of home improvement, Sweat's fire setting and voyeurisms were the only activities that brought him any happiness. The diary and videotapes helped him preserve the fantasy of each fire, and he clipped relevant stories from the newspaper. And as the manhunt unfolded, he felt the excitement of seeing his story on television every week. He had emotional reactions to the newscast, lashing out at residents who told reporters offhandedly that the arsonist needed mental help. Fair warning to the man on the street who insults a serial arsonist on camera. "It's too bad I don't know where you live, Sweat told me. He thought at such moments, for you'd surely be on my list. You know, Thomas Sweat knew all the faces of the fire and police departments, especially Ronald Blackwell, the task force spokesperson, and then D.C. Fire Chief Adrian Thompson. It was an additional thrill when men like these donned their caps and their medals and they called a press conference and they announced that yet another fire was being added to the arsonist's list. What the officials didn't know at the time was they stood before the cameras expressly because an admirer had summoned them." Investigators knew from the bags left behind at the fire scenes that the arsonist shopped at convenience stores. Now, there were dozens of 7-Elevens and scores of other corner stores in the area, but a spate of four fires within a week of one another in late 2004 helped them to narrow it down considerably. You see, the wreckage of a Northeast car fire, investigators pulled the remnants of a black plastic bag. It read, "Made in China for Cornelius Shop." The rest of the letters had been destroyed. Those remnants matched the remnants of a fire set days later, which allowed them to piece together an entire line, "Made in China for Cornelius Shopping Bag Company," a bag outfit in Richmond. The company supplied their black bags to just two shops in the D.C. area. They were a Circle 7 convenience stores, one on Killingworth Avenue Northeast and the other on Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue Southeast, just a short walk from the old Kenny and Paul barbershop. So, investigators put cameras in both stores and started what they called the black bag operation. Their idea was to preemptively put damning evidence into the arsonist's hands. So, with the cooperation of the owner of the two Circle 7 stores, agents affixed thumbnail-sized stainless steel chips to the bottom of every bag in both stores. Each chip was marked according to an alphanumeric code going in order through the stack. Now, if one of the bags were to be involved in a fire, the chip would survive, and because agents went to the store daily to track which bags had been used, they would be able to go through the video to see which customer had purchased the bag from the fire. On December 5th, 2004, a strange clue turned up a block away from the scene of an Arlington house fire. It was a Marine Corps cap and dress pants. The lab determined that DNA from the pants matched the DNA found at the other fire scenes. And so investigators started to think their arsonist was a jarhead. Agents from the Naval Criminal Investigative Services, NCIS, couldn't offer them DNA profiles of current Marines, but they did have a couple of leads on old barrack-related car fires. You see, a car had been captured on video leaving the scene of a fire and had been traced back to a man who lived right around the corner from the Circle 7 store on Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue. What was his name? Thomas Anthony Sweat. And so investigators started surveillance on Sweat, and he appeared to be an average working schlub, a loyal KFC employee with only minor, long-ago brushes with the law. And yet something seemed off about him. It was his meticulousness. As Fulkerson stalked him out at the KFC one day, he watched him from his unmarked car as Sweat walked outside the restaurant, got down on his knees, and started scraping stale gum from the cracks in the sidewalk. After not seeing any activity that would tie Sweat to the fires, Fulkerson and a DC detective walked into the KFC to interview him. Fulkerson told the cook he was looking for help in the serial arson case. He wanted to know if Sweat had seen anything. And finally, he asked him point blank, "Did you set the fires?" Sweat answered with a question of his own. "Why would I set those beautiful homes on fire when I'm trying to become a homeowner myself?" Fulkerson asked Sweat to submit to a DNA test, and he agreed. When Sweat went home, he destroyed the diary of fires. The swab of saliva went off to the lab, and days later, the crime tech had her results. She called Fulkerson and gave him what he had been waiting nearly 2 years for, a name. She said, "It's Thomas Sweat." God has been merciful and kind. I want to obey and keep his will. For I'm no longer worried about this life, but the life afterwards, Thomas Sweat says. There's still hope for all of us, no matter where we are. This old mortal body will soon be no more, but the soul will go to heaven or hell. I'm glad to know God is a forgiven God, and there is no sin so great he will not forgive. Isn't that a wonderful thought? Sweat was arrested on the morning of April 27, 2005, as he left a regional meeting for KFC employees held in District Heights. He maintained his innocence for an hour and a half of questioning before breaking down and admitting to the fires. As a stipulation of any plea agreement that might be offered, the government insisted that investigators be able to interview Sweat about his motives. They wanted to seize the rare opportunity to profile the mind of an extraordinary fire setter. It was time to finally be honest with himself and recognize who he was, said Fulkerson. He had been living this separate life for 30 years. He was absolutely exhausted. You'd think we were exhausted, but he looked worse. At times, Thomas Sweat choked up and cried. He admitted to killing not only Lou Edna Jones, but another elderly woman named Annie Brown, who died of smoke inhalation in a February 2002 fire in Northeast. Sweat hadn't even been considered a suspect in that fire until investigators discovered a news clip about the blaze in his apartment. One of Sweat's only requests was to meet Blackwell, the task force spokesperson, who had addressed Sweat through the media. Sweat told Blackwell he was sorry for all of the headaches. Blackwell told him it was okay. The whole thing was over now. And a shackled Sweat shook his hand.
Hey, Deuce Conrad here. I just want to tell you about Ibotta. Ibotta is one of the greatest things I have ever laid my eyes on. It's a great tool for actually earning money. And trust me, I've tried all these surveys and everything that the internet seems to say that you're going to make money, but nothing has made me money like Ibotta. In my first week of trying Ibotta, I earned approximately $40 just shopping. It's like coupon savings for people that don't like to clip coupons. Anyways, there is a link in the description of this podcast for you to become a partner with me in Ibotta. And when you submit your first receipt, you'll earn $10. That simple, that easy, just by going and shopping at places that you're already shopping, such as Walmart, Kroger, Publix. And it's easy to cash out as well. You can get gift cards to Amazon or have a direct payment made to you. Anyways, check the link down below. Use the referral code KAXRFWJ and earn $10 on your first receipt submitted.
Thomas Sweat signed a secret guilty plea within 2 weeks of his arrest. "It was the fastest we'd ever seen," says Fulkerson. He just wanted it over with. With Sweat's help, investigators closed out 353 fires. Apparently, that's all he could remember. These stretched back into the 80s. Never before had a detective questioned Sweat about any of them. After sentencing, Sweat was quickly sent to the United States Penitentiary at Terre Haute, the famously rough prison where Timothy McVeigh was put to death. Barring a transfer, Sweat will spend the rest of his life there. Thomas Sweat says that he still thinks often of fire, and that his mind tends to drift back to the old blazes, stirring feelings of exhilaration and shame. "Of course I see Everett Street each and every night," he wrote in reference to the fire that killed Jones. His fantasies now are the same as they were on the outside, the only difference being that the fire now lies beyond his reach. Until next time, I'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to the Deuce Conrad Show on Spotify Podcast. In case you didn't know, you can also hear this podcast on Google Podcast and Apple Podcast and most podcast platforms across the web. For more information about tonight's show, you can also visit www.deuceconradshow.com. Visit show notes for more details.